Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske. Culture.
Comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends.
Pop.
Pop. This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Culture Pop Podcast. I'm Steve Mason along with Sue Kalinske. Saturday, July the 11th, just after 11 a.m. Sue, how are you?
I'm wonderful.
Sue, you know who we thank all the time for being part of the Culture Pop Podcast?
Jacob and Ronnie.
That is correct. And, you know, more and more people are starting to get back out into their routine. And for some people, that means taking an Uber or a Lyft. And here's the thing. If I talked to Jacob last week, have you ever thought about what happens if you're injured in an Uber or Lyft accident? Jacob says, first of all, think about yourself. The drivers of the two cars involved in the accident are only worried about themselves. You, the passenger, pretty much on your own. Once the car gets to a safe area, take pictures of both cars, not just the car you're in. Also, ask the insurance information from both the Uber Lyft driver and the other car involved. Don't rely on the Uber driver to get this information. And if the police come, do not be silent. Tell them your side of the story. Be active. Even if you were in an Uber accident before the pandemic hit, you still got rights, but you got to act fast. Any type of injury, call Jacob. 844-24-JACOB. That's 844-24-JACOB. 844-24-JACOB. Or Sue, I'm looking for harmony here. Are you ready?
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to try to learn how to do something instrumental because I'm not really good with the harmony. I'm going to try to do something with a guitar.
You're going to try to learn guitar for the Jacob or Ronnie jingle?
For the Jacob song, yes.
All right.
Or harmonica, something
okay.
Like that.
Accident or injury, call Jacob and Ronnie, call Jacob. So, Sue, I just have to, you know, I made this joke in the past, but first of all, we're really happy that Chris Morales is now back part of the show with this brand new system that we're using to do the podcast. So thank you, Chris, for being out there. Sue, you dealing with the technology associated with this new system have been just a handful. You've been a handful.
Oh, come on. You really over-exaggerate. It was like a moment. Just a moment. I am so on board. I know exactly what I'm doing.
You're not going to win the technology contest.
Well, you know what it is? You just have this affinity to make fun of me. That's just one of your joys in life.
Doesn't that go both ways?
I don't make as much fun of you as you make of me. And it's not that I'm keeping score.
Do you think it should be more equitable? You think you should be making, because my advice to you is just make more fun of me. That way things will even up.
Yeah. I mean, I make fun, you know, when it's warranted. You embellish. You're the embellisher.
All right. Sue, you ever been on a good trip? Hallucinogenic trip?
Many.
We're going to talk about that, and plus more. Our guest has made one of the really fun Netflix movies of the summer. It's called Have a Good Trip. He was also the head writer for David Letterman at NBC and then later at CBS, and he has been the executive producer of The Simpsons. He did 4 years on that project. Donick Cary is here. Donick, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it, man.
Glad to be here.
So why were hallucinogenics the right subject for a movie with you?
Initially the instinct was looking for comedy, and there's an interesting thing when you put hallucinogenics on someone's brain and see what happens. And especially celebrities and interesting people, I thought that was a recipe for something that might lead to some comedy.
Do you have a broad background in LSD and mushrooms and all that kind of stuff?
I do not. I wouldn't say I have a broad background in it. You know, I think my experiences growing up were, you know, heavily on research, which was like reading 1,000 books and understanding the psychedelic space and what some of those people who had traveled those roads had learned and shared. And I was always a very cautious kid where I tried everything, but also was like, once I figured out what I needed to know, I would move on quickly.
So I wanted to ask you, like, how old were you the first time you dropped acid?
You know, here's what I would say. I've been very cautious with this movie because, you know, like as we were editing, I'm raising two kids. I'm also very careful not to be an advocate for recreational drug use. I think there's a lot of mistakes you can make. But on the other side, for me, it was growing up in the Reagan era, Just Say No era, which was very, you didn't even talk about it. The idea was like, if you even touch drugs, you jump out a window. And I was like, that's also not the reality. And really what is more interesting is a rational conversation about what these things are, what they do, how you make safe choices, how you stay away from them if they're not right for you. Exploring these kind of new areas in mental health and therapy and treatment that have shown that they can have benefits is good. But anyway, I'm not an advocate for anybody doing anything that's for anything. By the way, in the movie we even talked about, like, some people shouldn't drink coffee, you know, it's everybody's brain's different.
Right. You got an unbelievable group of celebrities to talk to you, Sarah Silverman and Nick Offerman and Sting, Anthony Bourdain, Carrie Fisher, Ben Stiller, Mark Maron. How did you make those approaches to them?
You guys probably know a little bit of this equation, which is to book anything, you just throw it out to as many people as you can get to hear the pitch, and then you see what comes in. And this was a case of like starting with, you know, I'm a comedy writer, producer, you know, you meet a lot of people who you can ask if they'd be interested. And a lot of people, you know, this is a weird space where it's been taboo for a lot of years to talk about. And so it was really a pounding the pavement, asking everybody we could get. And then this sort of wonderful, surprising thing that every once in a while I get an email that said, like, Sting wants to talk to you. He's available next February on a Tuesday at 10 a.m. in New York. And I'd go like, well, okay, yeah, great. Well, I'll be there, you know. So it was like 100 asks for every 10 people who said yes, kind of thing.
So did you have to do like research on, like, did you know that all these people had dropped acid, or how did you find this out?
Here's where it all started, which was kind of the same for everyone, which was, you know, I was having lunch with Ben Stiller. We're on the board of a film festival together. I see him once a year. He told the story that's in the movie. He told that story at lunch, and I was like, I would never think of Ben as someone who's ever done acid. And I was also really excited because he told a story that was really a cautionary tale. That was like, this thing was not good for me. I thought the people who mostly would share these stories will be not necessarily advocates for it, but at least making it sound fun and maybe a little more recreational. And when I knew I had Ben, at least going like, this is not for me. This was not like a thing. And also in a really funny way, I was like, oh, that gives us one edge, and then we can go out and find other people. In general, people who don't want to talk about it, don't even talk about it. You know, you just get a no. A lot of people have like a deal with Walt Disney right now or whatever, and are like, I'm not talking about drugs. And there was a weird mix in the sober community too, where it's like, there's a lot of people who had, you know, problems with other drugs that then didn't want to talk about these drugs, or had a great story because they had practiced it over 20 years in you know, 12-step programs. So it's a wild mix.
Yeah. So since we're on this subject, I tried it once and I had what would be called a bad trip. I had at Bowling Green, we had magic mushrooms when I was going in my fraternity house. Took the magic mushrooms, and there was a Sting album. I'm sorry, not a Sting album, a Styx album sitting on the the floor right by me. And it had the Mr. Roboto. If you remember the Mr. Roboto robot on the Styx album.
Yeah, terrifying.
And I just had nightmares about that thing coming after me. And I never did LSD, never did shrooms again. That was more than enough for me. I couldn't wait for it to be over.
Yeah. I think that's the experience of a lot of people, is if you stumble into it recreationally and thinking like, oh, this will be like going on a roller coaster, that'll be fun. And then you get on and you're like, oh, this is way different than that. And it lasts 12 hours. Hell, you know, you panic, you know, it leads you to have all these panic instincts and stuff. And it just makes it worse and worse and worse. I think where the really interesting conversation, and this isn't that funny, but the interesting thing I think that I found was where this has potential is in a very different context now, is in therapeutic contexts with people who are suffering anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, things that are like we don't have good answers for in our mental health profession. And when used carefully, this can help some people. That's, I guess, the easiest way to say it. But yeah, taking a handful of anything and wandering around and seeing what happens can lead to bad things, especially when that sticks robot is in the room.
Yes.
Well, what about that baseball player, Doc Ellis? I'm sure you've heard about him. He pitched a no-hitter, stoned on acid.
Yes. Yes. That came out probably about a year after we started this, and I went, oh, no, they're doing our thing. And then I was like, oh, it doesn't matter. It's all fun. That's a hilarious story. That's amazing. You know, it does give you the impression that maybe you get superpowers, which is not necessarily the truth. Though for Doc Ellis, it did help him with that game. So who knows? Who knows?
My experience with acid, I ate acid for the first time when I was in eighth grade, which is very, very young.
That is young for acid.
Right. But there were always kind of rules and regulations to eating it. It was like, okay, well, I had to tell my parents that I was like at maybe 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I had to let them know that I was sleeping at a friend's house. Like there was no way I could go home. And it always depended on the environment was the result of what my trip was going to be. Like if I was tripping with somebody who was really paranoid, then it would bleed into me and it would ruin my trip. So I'd have to like go away from them.
Right.
Because I had a combination of really good trips and then really scary trips, but I had to go home a couple of times. And that was the most frightening to me because, I mean, if my parents knew that I was 13 years old, like if they knew I smoked cigarettes at 13, they would have killed me.
Right.
And
right.
They were an older generation. I'm the youngest of five. So they knew nothing about drugs. And I came home to a house full of like my parents' friends. My parents are having a party.
Ugh.
And I had to like slip upstairs into my bedroom and just be by myself. And I kept on hearing people calling my name, but I wasn't sure whether they were calling my name. So I didn't want to say what, because if I said what, they'd be like, why are you saying what? It was like, it was so freaky. And then I did the worst thing anybody can do when you're flipping out is I went into the bathroom. I was hiding in the bathroom and I looked in the mirror and it was like,
right.
I was like a monster. My face was green. It was just the scariest thing. And then I did it again. And then I had a great time.
Right. You're like, there must be something else here.
Yeah. So it can be very scary.
Overall, do you feel like you took away good lessons, bad lessons, even with the bad stuff, found anything good or you know, where do you put that now in your life?
I'm really glad that I experienced it. But what I realized is that I am someone who has a very low tolerance. Like I drink, but you know, I'm like a two beer, two glass of wine person. I smoke pot, but yeah. You know, I'm a couple of hits and I'm out. But the scary thing about acid, and especially.
This is a pretty honest podcast, Donick, as you can tell.
But you know,
yeah, that's good.
But the scary thing about acid when I was doing it is that blotter acid was very, very popular. So it's a piece of paper, and sometimes when they put the drop of acid on it, it wasn't equally distributed. So
right.
I was with friends, and we were all splitting a hit, and one person got all the acid, and one person just got paper.
Yeah.
And this person was like I thought they were going to have a heart attack. I mean, it was scary to watch, but it never deterred me from doing it again.
But all in all, you're happy that you did
it. I'm very happy that I did it because I'm glad that I had the experience and I laughed my head off when it was fun.
Right.
So, Donick, one thing that makes your movie I just think is brilliant is the animation. The stories are fantastic. You know, there's that story about Sting and the peyote trip in Mexico and all that stuff. But then the animation sort of brings the whole thing to life. How, in your mind as a filmmaker, did that idea take shape?
There were a couple things. One of them was necessity, which was, you know, to try to bring to life hallucinations and trippy spaces, like, and do it in any kind of convincing way with real life effects and stuff would have been way too expensive. So in a weird way, animation was the obvious thing for us to play with because you could kind of bring anything to life for the same price, you know? But more than that, I thought there was something really interesting with being able to play with these couple of different levels of reality where our live action people could kind of morph into animation and then that go in the worlds, which would be sort of this, you know, at least symbolic or share the idea of what happens when you take these drugs as you kind of morph into this other world that that flows and is liquid and colors breathe and all that stuff, which is sort of what happens you can do in cartoons. So that's kind of where that came from.
Did your background with The Simpsons, you spent a few years with The Simpsons as executive producer. Did that play a role in how you went about the animation?
Yeah, for sure. One of the first week I was at The Simpsons, there's something called an animatic, which comes in halfway through the animation process. And I started on the show, and the animatic is like a pencil drawing test of like the whole episode. And it happened to be the episode where Homer eats chili peppers and has this crazy trip and looks for his soulmate and finds Marge. And Johnny Cash is his spirit guide through a wolf. And it was a trip episode. And it was like my first episode there. And I was so blown away that I was, got to work at The Simpsons. I was so excited to be there. And then I was like, whoa, you could do anything with animation. This is unbelievable. I wrote another episode while I was there called Doughin' in the Wind, where Homer accidentally doses the whole town with a mushroom mix of just stuff. Again, it was really fun to bring to life like what everyone in Springfield sees. So, you know, that was always in my mind. Animation is easy to take you places, and the people love those episodes too. So it was fun to I don't know, seemed obvious, no brainer.
You know, going back to you had talked about the therapeutic side of acid. You know, for someone who has done it, I can't even imagine doing acid and with my therapist.
Right.
I mean, there was years ago, it was called MDMA, and my sister actually used to do it. I guess it was used for patients who had a hard time opening up in therapy.
Right.
And she used to do it with her therapist, which is, to me, like mind blowing. Like
But Donna, the thing I think you found out was it's being used for depression. It's being used for anxiety, for PTSD. They're discovering all kinds of new uses for hallucinogenics, right?
Yeah, and I think that the way to think about it, because it's like I think some of us who had recreational trips as kids, and like you said, Sue, like. You didn't know what the dose was. You didn't know if you were going to end up in your bedroom or you have to talk to your parents or whatever. Like those were like kind of anything can happen. Now, when you do it in a therapeutic setting, there's a lot of harm reduction taken out of it. There's a lot of work that people do beforehand that is just regular therapy, where therapists are familiar with the drug, the medicine, whatever you want to call this. They know what the dosage is, so they're not going to give you four hits of acid and see what happens. You know, they're going to give you a dose that they think is right for that person and what they're trying to figure out. The best way I can kind of verbalize it after talking about this a lot with people is a lot of those things, whether it's addiction or anxiety or depression, are things where you've gotten into a box. You can't get yourself out of it. You can't really figure out a way. And psychedelics propel you out of that box for an afternoon or an evening or whatever. And in a lot of cases, that helps people get out of these things and look back down at it and reflect on it and maybe, be a catalyst for positive change. But, it's personal and depends on the situation. So I always urge caution for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I know someone who did that. Was it ayahuasca? Is that what it's called? He went on a retreat.
Yep.
And he had been in the military. He didn't have PTSD or anything because he wasn't in a war zone. But he was in the military for a while. And I think he was doing it basically as just a, you know, spiritual awakening, just to learn about himself. And he, for him, it was an amazing experience. I could only imagine, because I've seen some specials on it, where some people were so in their head that it only magnified what they felt when they were doing it. And for some people, they were totally freaking out. And then other people allowed themselves to go through the freaking out because they came out on the other end in a much better place. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing, because when I started this movie, I was calling it Bad Trip, because I thought those would be the funniest. And you know, like, mm-hmm. when you survive the talk about them, those usually make pretty funny stories, because you live to talk about it. But in therapy, what's interesting is often the therapists are telling people, don't run away from something that's dark. Usually that's the thing you're trying to figure out and get through. And this is heightening that in a way that you can confront it, you know, and it might lead to some sort of breakthrough. Again, I'm not an expert in this space. I just talk to a lot of them you know, I can appreciate what they're working on. And it does take a lot of work. You know, it's a combination of preparation, careful, you know, execution of it, and then integrating it afterwards and figuring out what you've learned and what you can do. The thing that we all, you know, take away, whether you had a good trip or a bad trip, like, you have incredibly big, crazy, sometimes beautiful, sometimes funny insights into stuff. And some of those things, like, to me, the ones that come away are like, oh, right, it reminds you that we're all connected. Like, you believe that you're part of the trees, and we're all made of the same stuff. And these kind of things that are like, seem hard to verbalize in our normal life, you have these profound realizations that's what it's all about. We're supposed to love each other. And then you're like, come back and you deliver that news to anyone, and they're like, uh-huh, okay, settle down. You know, like, there's sort of two languages you have to speak or something. I don't know.
So, aside from the movie, you were a writer for Late Night with David Letterman. Later, you became the head writer when Dave moved to CBS. There's nobody that has been more influential on my shaping of what is funny than David Letterman has been. What was it like being in that writer's room? What was it like working with Dave?
I feel very lucky. I'm like you. You know, there's no one who shaped the early part of my career and how I saw comedy and what you aspire to every day, of like trying to come up with something new and crazy and different and smart and funny and dumb and all those things all at the same time. I was really lucky to be there for the last couple years at NBC and the first couple years at CBS, maybe three at each or two. And I can never quite do the math. But, you know, it was a time where Dave was celebrating what he had done at NBC and also trying something new and getting a lot of praise at CBS. So we had all eyes on us. You know, it's really fun to be in a place. It just doesn't exist now, where, you know, you write a bunch of jokes, they go on TV, and then people are talking about them the next day. That was like the weirdest, most fun thing. Plus, you know, I was a kid, I was young and first job. And every day it was like, REM's here. Bill Murray wants someone to come up with some jokes for this thing he's doing. Steve Martin's down there. Bill Clinton's stopping by later. Madonna's here. Like, it was the craziest place to be, like, expected to be funny all the time, you know, and not be like, wait, what's Madonna like? How are you supposed to talk to Madonna? I don't know. It was great. It was great. It was the thing I would say is, I don't know how many days a week you guys do the podcast, but after a while, you've been there 5 years and you're like, it's like Groundhog Day. You wake up and you're like, oh, we got to do it again. Oh, we got to do it again. Oh, we got to do it again. There's a grind, you know, and we need more top tens. We need more top tens. That's really fun. And it's a ridiculous luxury that you get to do them and people like them. But, after 5 years of doing them, you're like, I don't know if I can think of another Zemarski joke or whatever we were working on at that time, you know, so it becomes a grind. And I was, you know, thrilled to get there. I thought I'd be there the rest of my life, because it was the only, you know, place I really thought loved, you know. And but I was burning out. I was 25 years old and I was exhausted, and I was like, I was getting sick. Mm-hmm. I had pneumonia, and I was like, what is wrong with me? I'm like a 90-year-old man. And I realized, like, I was just being ground, you know, the the pressure was getting to me.
You know, when the show, because you were on both shows, so the show went from 12:30 to 11:30. What was there a stark difference as to what content you were able to do an hour earlier?
Yeah, there was. I mean, there was a lot of analysis and thought about how we appeal to a broader audience. You know, and you know, it was sometimes we did it successfully, bringing the weirdness of the late night show into a more primetime, not primetime, but, you know, an earlier audience and Broadway and stuff. And sometimes it felt like, oh, that felt a little bit like it didn't quite work, you know, but it was, that show was, what was great about that show was it was always an experiment. You know, all the good ones were like, hey, we're trying something new. We don't know if it's going to work or not. And sometimes that led to spectacular failures that were so compelling to watch. And sometimes that led to like dead air that was like, oh boy, we didn't get it tonight. But there was also this weird thing that happened is, you know, we literally moved into a Broadway theater and we're taping at 5:30 in the afternoon to air that night. And it was like Broadway crowds were coming to the show before they'd go to the theater. And it was like, it was sort of like, oh, this isn't the weirdos who are staying up until 1:30 at night, analyzing Brother Theodore or whatever. These are like people who are out for a fun time and you definitely want them laughing. So, you know, you cater to that a little bit because you want them to love the show, but it was always trying to find that fine balance of keeping it weird, keeping it smart and funny, but also appealing to as many people as possible.
I just wanted to follow up on that because there was one thing that I remember because I did stand-up comedy for a very long time. So I remember hearing that Bill Hicks, who was one of my all-time favorite comedians, was booked for the first show of the CBS reign. And Letterman decided to not air his set because he was afraid that coming onto a newer network and at a earlier time slot, Bill's material may not be the best show to kick off. And I had read that years later, because Hicks was like Letterman's favorite comic as well.
Yep.
And he said that that was the one thing that he did that he regrets, that he didn't let the show go on. Do you remember that?
I don't remember exactly that. I think it was, but I'm not positive. I'm not the person to talk to. I by the way, also love Bill Hicks. We have a great clip of him in Have a Good Trip talking about LSD, and
yes.
He's amazing. I think he was booked on the NBC show one night and got bumped because of some material, and then Dave always regretted that. In my recollection, he was not on that first CBS show. That was pretty set with, we had Paul Newman and Bill Murray and forgetting who the musical guest was. Somebody else killed.
Yeah, Bill Murray. Didn't he tear down the desk or something?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But the Bill Hicks thing, I don't remember specifically. I know that there was a booking that got bumped somewhere and it was a regret. And I think Morty's talked about that. I don't know. But yeah.
Donna, what do you think of the late night guys today? Colbert and Fallon and Kimmel and Corden and Seth Meyers and those guys.
I've been working on a show called AP Bio that Seth Meyers is a producer on. So I love him the best. I would say, I've known Jimmy forever. He's a great guy. I love Stephen Colbert. I would say what's nice about these guys, and starting with Conan in a lot of ways, like, they're all, you know, and Jon Stewart, everybody was raised on Letterman, took the best of what Dave did, really studied him, you know, and then has, in at least from where I'm sitting, figured out how to do this in a way that didn't torture themselves, where they could still have fun with it, where I think Dave might have leaned into the torture a little bit to the point of giving himself a heart attack. That these guys are still having fun with it. You know, like when I watch Jimmy, I know he's taking a break right now, but you know, when I watch Jimmy do the show, I'm like, he really loves doing this every night, even, you know, and Colbert really loves doing it. And, you know, like that there's a joy that sometimes that Dave just didn't have, that he was like, I'm angry that we have to do this. I'm like, okay, well, you know, we're just making a joke.
Yeah. So they found a way to find some joy in the grind. That exists, yeah, when you're doing five shows a week, I guess.
And whether they learned that from Dave watching him and going like, you know, I don't want to get so angry about all this. I want to have some fun. You know, like it's a really fun thing. Now, the weird thing is there's so many of those shows there's not the consensus viewing anymore. You know, like we used to all have to watch the same things because there wasn't that much stuff. And now everybody's got such, you know, fragmented audiences and stuff that it's harder. Personally for me, like I burned out on late night and then I didn't watch it that much anymore after I left. So
yeah,
I check in once in a while.
Well, listen, we appreciate you coming on the show today. The movie's really, really fun and engaging. It's called Have a Good Trip.
Yep.
And recommend that. It is on Netflix right now. Thanks a lot for doing this, Donick. Really appreciate it, man.
I love it. Love talking about it. Thank you guys for watching and enjoying. And call anytime.
Thanks.
Cool. Thanks, Donick.
All right. Have a good one.
There you have it, Donna Carey. Really fun movie. And I did not expect him to be, I expected, yeah, the time I did peyote in New Mexico. Like, that's what I was expecting from him. He was very cautious about his own stories. But the other stories in the documentary are fantastic.
You know, it was interesting that Carrie Fisher said that she felt more normal doing acid than she did in regular life.
Yeah, which is crazy. One time, I was one and done. One and done, that's it. Junior at Bowling Green State University, can't do it anymore. You, eighth grade.
But I only ate acid like four times. And then, you know, I actually like mushrooms a lot because mushrooms is a milder, it's more giggly, it's not as, it's not as visual. It's just a heightened sense of yourself. Like you feel it kind of through your body and yep. Everything is just funny.
Yeah. And for me, Styx, Mr. Roboto album coming at me when I was on shrooms. Coming at me. So it was not fun for me. It's but it's really interesting. And, you know, the efficacy of LSD, hallucinogenics with depression, anxiety, PTSD, other mental ailments has been now proven, and the research is continuing. I thought that was interesting about David Letterman, the 5 day a week grind, which, you know, I can tell you that I always joke with Bryan Cranston, how can you do 8 shows a week when he's on Broadway? And he's like, well, I don't know. Your gig seems tougher. You have to do 5 different shows a week. But there is a grind that goes into that. And it sounds like Dave, well, at least for Donick, the grind did get to him. And it sounds like it got to Dave, too.
Well, you know, with a show like that, the amount of material that you have to produce has got to be, like, insane.
Yeah.
You have to write so many jokes. You probably have to write like 100 jokes a day.
Really? And 100 that, jokes? How many make the cut?
Three?
You think, right? You know,
who knows?
Jokes,
maybe.
Three make the cut?
Maybe. Maybe. Oh. Of yours. You're wow. Just one writer. 100 may be a bit of an exaggeration, but you have to write such a tremendous amount of material every day. And I never worked on a show like that, but I remember having to put a packet together because I had an interview for Bill Maher's show when he was doing Politically Incorrect.
Yep.
And I wrote with a partner and we put a packet of jokes together and we wrote like 50 jokes just for the packet.
Wow. Wow.
So, you know, it's an insane amount of work.
Yeah. I miss Dave. I know he's doing his other talk show, but for me, the intellectual Dave isn't really the same as the goofy Dave that I remember watching all those years. And my favorite Dave was the late night with David Letterman, Dave on NBC. Those mm-hmm. were that was when I was in college. We'd all stay awake to watch Dave. That would have been the early 80s and just absolutely where my sense of humor came from. What I think is funny is chances are something Dave has done sometime.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, Chris Elliott and Meryl Marco, who's a, you know, dear friend of mine, you know, she was head writer and, you know, Stupid Petrix and going, you know, backstage and going into the control room.
Top 10 lists. I mean, all that stuff. I was just thinking in my head, do you remember when he wore the giant suit of Velcro?
Yeah.
And jumped up and stuck himself to the wall.
Yeah.
Nobody's doing that now. Right. Nobody's doing that bit.
Right.
That bit is one of the best.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, thank you very much for listening, everybody. Don't forget the very the best thing that you can do for us as we continue to build the show is to subscribe. You can go to stevemason.com and there's really clearly subscribe either on iTunes or on Spotify. We appreciate you doing that right now. And Sue, thanks a lot. We will talk to you next week.
Goodbye.
Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode of Culture Pop.